Hi there. This is Nick Savvides. You're listening to the NSavvides podcast. This is a show where we talk about the art of collaboration, of working together with others to do great, creative, imaginative things. Our guest today is Jeff Jasper. He's a visual effects supervisor at New Deal Studios. For those of you who don't know New Deal Studios, they've been doing effects work for over 20 years. And they're one of the few effects houses in the world that specializes in doing miniatures work. They do digital effects as well, but they're really known for building miniatures. Jeff has been with the company for years. He started as a digital artist and compositor, and he has moved up to technical lead and visual effects supervisor. Some of the films that he's worked on include Oz, Great and Powerful, Hangover Part 3, Star Trek Into Darkness, Avengers, Iron Man, Shutter Island, Inception, and the three that we're going to talk about today in a little bit of detail, Dark Knight, Hugo, and Interstellar. It just so happens Hugo is my favorite Scorsese film and Interstellar is my favorite Christopher Nolan film, so it was quite an honor to talk to Jeff about some of the effects work that made those films so distinct and memorable. Interstellar only won one Oscar award. It was for visual effects. Jeff was part of the team at New Deal that got the Oscar. They shared it with Double Negative. So there you go. As I mentioned moments ago, we talk about some of the work that Jeff and his team did on those three films. We also look at miniatures, how to prepare for them, when to use them, how they're different from digital effects. We also talk about New Deal, the company. They have this tradition of treating their employees better. They go out of their way to treat their employees right, and that makes a difference in the work they do. As a bonus, at the end of this, you're going to get my take on some of the Christopher Nolan films. It's like there's something going on in these films, and I talk about it a little bit, kind of. All that and more coming up in our conversation with Jeff Jasper. Stick around. This is the NSavvides podcast. Hello, hello, hello. All right, Jeff Jasper, welcome to the NSavvides podcast.
Excellent. Thanks for having me.
You are the digital effects supervisor at New Deal. Give us a quick overview of what that entails.
New Deal's a unique company in that we do a lot of practical effects work. So for our digital department, we're doing everything from previs to build design. So like construction drawings, CAD work, all the way through post-digital. So like your traditional digital effects studio type work. Through the process where we're kind of converting and reusing the assets along the pipeline from each of those disciplines. Also, since we are shooting a lot of our own stuff, we do like motion control camera move programming, which we handle through the previs, as well as just like set planning.
So it sounds like you have your hand in the effect sequences from beginning to end, right?
Yes, yes. So depending on the project and what we're contracted to do, sometimes we can work on stuff for over a year just for a few shots.
Oh, no kidding. Wow. A number of filmmakers have probably heard of shooting miniatures, but maybe they haven't had the opportunity to try it yet on their own projects. What are some things you would suggest for them to keep in mind when considering that approach?
Usually what we do is someone will approach us with a script to bid, and we'll go through and we'll actually look at kind of what they're looking for, talk to them about their vision for the scenes, and we'll evaluate kind of what the best solution is, whether, you know, sometimes a digital solution may be the best solution, or a lot of times if it's stuff that's going to like explode or have pyrotechnic works, usually that's best done practically. As good as a lot of the fluid solvers are, they never quite look as good as the real thing, especially if you build a large scale model.
Sure. So the collisions and explosions work well with miniatures. What are some other examples when it makes sense to go the miniatures route?
If you want something that really has a deep hold in reality. So a lot of the projects we've done for Christopher Nolan and stuff could be done digitally, but all the kind of nuanced detail you get with actually building things practically and detailing them as you would a physical set is really, really hard to get digitally. So everything ends up looking real because it is real. And you're not trying to mimic reality. You're just recreating reality at a smaller scale.
Conversely, when would you suggest that filmmakers might want to consider digital effects for a certain sequence?
Anything that kind of bends the laws of physics, stuff where, you know, it might be too dangerous to do practically.
Like Spider-Man jumping around from building to building kind of stuff?
Yeah, and also then like the Spider-Man sequences where you have huge moves where the camera is traveling along with him as he's moving throughout the city that would be nearly impossible to shoot practically. And those kind of things are best done digitally. A lot of spaceship stuff could be done just as well digitally now as practically, although sometimes we did tons of work on Interstellar, all the spaceships in the movie where it's traveling around in space are all model miniatures. And so it's just kind of weighing the look that you want to have.
We'll talk more about Interstellar in a moment, but as we were saying before, a lot of the demolition effects are done with miniatures, right?
Yes.
So in those cases, you're building these sets that take months to build, and then they're going to get smashed or blown up. How many sets do you all have for those shots? Do you plan for 3 or 4 takes for the big sequences, or just 1 or 2 takes, or what?
Generally, I mean, we always preferred 3, but generally the budget allotted for 2 takes. And so we would do our best to get like a really, really good first take. And then if that was kind of the in the can shot and everything went great, then for the second take, we would do kind of go over the top and try and do pull in any other ideas that the director may have.
Has there ever been an instance where you all lived dangerously and just budgeted for 1 take?
Yes. Yes, we've worked on projects where they just didn't feel they had the budget to do it twice. And we've done it in 1 take, and fingers crossed, knock on wood, we've always had it work out where we've been able to get it in 1 take. But it is a costly gamble. If something goes wrong, you got to live with with what you got.
Yeah, I imagine those must be solemn conversations. I mean, there's always the chance of a camera malfunction or a technical issue that comes up or whatnot.
Yeah, we had one we did for a Korean action film where we're blowing up a building, and the building was all like real modern glass and metal. Each level was like blowing up, and then the building kind of pancaked down. And we had 1 shot to get it, and it was an extremely complicated shot to pull off. And we're shooting it outside and just assembling it and getting everything perfect and the glass, you know, perfectly clean, no fingerprints and all that kind of stuff. It's very nerve-wracking.
Yeah, it's almost like mission control for NASA, right? You've got 1 shot to get this right. A lot of pressure, a lot of people depending on it.
Yeah, and it definitely helps. We have pyro people that are extremely talented and been in the industry forever and really good engineers who did simulations beforehand, actual engineering simulations and stuff. And so we try and cover our bases as best as we can.
You all can do both miniatures and digital effects. So do you usually get to work on an entire sequence from beginning to end, or does some of it get farmed out to other vendors?
Both. Sometimes we do it ourselves. Sometimes we hand it back over. A lot of times we've been a subcontractor to some of the larger digital effects studios. And and they want to do the compositing themselves. But sometimes, you know, they're slammed with work too, and they'll let us kind of own the shots and do everything ourselves. We prefer it because we're so familiar with the shot and we know what will kind of sell the shot best. So we always push to kind of handle it all in-house if we can.
What are some of the advantages to the studios or the filmmakers hiring you when you all handle a sequence all the way through?
The biggest advantage is just the familiarity with all the details and all everything that's going into the shot. The setup, so we design it around how we would composite it within the shot. And so it's just unloading their plate and be like, if you just trust us, we're going to deliver a shot to you. It's going to look perfect and you'll be happy. You won't have to think about it. You'll just have a final shot. If it's people we've worked with and they trust us, then it's worked out great in the past, and they'll usually, once we do it once, then they'll come back to us over and over again.
I've had some of my visual effects friends tell me that sometimes when a shot does get contracted to different vendors, there can be a misunderstanding about the impact of an explosion or just people working on different scales. And so that might have one element disproportionately affected. Have you all run into that kind of thing on occasion?
It generally doesn't happen because we're so connected with the company who's contracting us out. So we'll have the effects supervisor from production on set with us, as well as if it's another digital company that we're working with, they'll be on set with us. And we've all been talking about the goals of the shots throughout. And so everybody's kind of on the same base, and, you know, they're seeing things happen with their own eyes. And so if anything's not looking like it's going to hit what they're going for, then we make adjustments there with them. So they kind of have a guarantee and comfort level that they're
right.
going to get what they need.
So you have that ongoing dialogue.
Yeah. It's very similar to like just being on set with normal production. So they're there, they're seeing things happen. And so there's no like, you know, send it out, get something back a month later. And that's when you see whether it's wrong or not.
Yeah. And that can be a costly amount of man hours spent.
Yes. Yes.
As a visual effects supervisor for the facility, are you working most closely with the visual effects supervisor for the project, or is it a mix of people?
Yes. So mostly I'll be with the VFX suit from production, as well as our producers. And so we have, you know, on-set producers and then people who kind of handle client relations, as well as coordinating with our design team.
Oh, so you guys actually have producers who are on set for much of the shooting?
Correct, yes.
Okay.
But usually the VFX suit for production will be coming in and out throughout the whole process, from initial consultation all the way through post. And so we'll have built a relationship along the way that helps things go along smoothly.
Does the director ever check in with you all?
Sometimes. Usually, a lot of times it's just the effects supervisor, but some directors are very hands-on with the whole process, and so they like to be on set too and see things being shot, and also communicative as to what we're doing as a vendor on their project.
Give it that personal connection, like, here's how it connects to the rest of the story and whatnot.
Yeah, it comes down to the kind of the personality and working style of the director as to what they prefer. Some of them just, you know, they really trust their effects soup, and they've worked with them on many movies, and so they just let that person handle all the work, all that load. But then some of them are really, really like to be hands-on with everything.
You've maintained ongoing relationships with high-profile people. Christopher Nolan has worked with you on a couple of projects. So has Martin Scorsese and the Walt Disney Company. So it seems like they're happy with the relationship.
Yeah.
It's not always the case when doing effects work. It can be a little stressful. So talk about how you all maintain those relationships over time.
I think generally a lot of the people that come to us are really passionate about the craft of filmmaking. And so these are people who sometimes still shoot with film cameras in the world of digital cameras, like Christopher Nolan, or they just really feel comfortable with the look and the physicality of having a practical model or practical sets versus like virtual sets or digital models. Or they're doing a type of film that just kind of lends itself to that reality. At this point, there's really very few companies that are doing it. And New Deal's had a long history of doing it well. They trust that we're going to realize the vision that they have for their project. And so, you know, that those first projects are always tense, and doing miniatures can be intimidating because you have to put a lot of forethought into it. There's no kind of fix it and post and all that. You have to really plan things up front. You also have to, as a director, really commit to the vision of what you're going to shoot. So it takes a certain kind of director to kind of commit to that workflow of like committing early, having a clear vision and working through it, where some directors prefer to have, you know, ultimate flexibility and be able to change things at any point.
Like an hour before, what if we shoot this other side that we haven't built yet? Sure, sure, yeah. I've heard your co-founder, Shannon Gans, on lynda.com and one or two other videos, and I was surprised by how often she talked about the value you all place in your people, and specifically not working them long hours.
Yes.
That's not something I hear a lot of other VFX places say, and it seems like it's an important value to you all. I was wondering if you could elaborate on that.
Yeah, I mean, we always felt there was, you know, you get real diminishing returns when people are burned out or overworked and aren't getting enough sleep. And, you know, they're not happy, especially if they're on like a pay system that's not covering all the work that they're putting in extra. And so New Deal always kind of committed to we had always shoot for an 8-hour day, and we always paid overtime, and we always tried to keep people from getting burnout. With production, those are long days, but you're getting production pay. And so there's no like day rates or week rates or anything like that, where you're working a 14-hour day, but only get paying for 8 hours of those days. And so that was one thing that, you know, helped us maintain artists. We felt it maintained creativity with the artists, and artists were in general much happier if they didn't feel like, you know, they were under the whip.
And that's notable because a lot of the VFX houses don't pay overtime, at least not all of it, right? It's an unfortunate side of the effects business where a lot of places will just say, hey, it's part of the job, so deal with it.
Yeah, and it's really hard since, you know, it's a freelance industry and there's so much like kind of shady practices or gray area as to some of the legality of what happens in our industry. And so it's very easy for artists to get taken advantage, especially if they're newer, younger artists. And it's a real shame that hopefully someday gets addressed on a better scale. Yeah, it's very common, especially 1099 artists, if they're not really on top of maintaining themselves as like a independent business, and then more than likely they're probably getting screwed a little bit, or freelancers in general, if they're really not protecting themselves. It's very, very hard.
And for those who don't know, the 1099 people are the freelancers who are technically not company employees, correct?
Correct.
And it seems like some effects companies are trying to get the benefits of employees while paying them as freelancers.
Correct. And even for us with our freelance staff, and we tried to handle them like they were employees and do, you know, W-2s. Like I said, we paid hourly, and we handled taxes, all the workers' comp, all the things that you would with an employee. We felt it was best for the company and best for the employees themselves.
Really? You do that even for your freelancers?
Yeah. Unless someone specifically, you know, because sometimes people have their own company set up and they handle things that works best for them tax reason wise and stuff, and they'll want to do 1099. We would do it for them. So if someone requested it, we would do it for them. But even if they were doing 1099, we still paid them their hourly rate and overtime, and so pretty much every hour you're working, you're getting paid for it.
Well, that is very admirable. Do you ever get any pushback from the studios? It seems like a number of the effects windows get smaller and smaller, so there's this push to get things out faster and faster. Do they ever ask you for more overtime and then promise to make it up to you later?
Yeah, they'll ask for overtime, and we're willing to accommodate overtime. We just had to tell them that they're going to be paying for it. So that's we actually do change orders and hold the studios to change orders. So we never really did the flat billing to the studios where, you know, you bid something up front and they hold that over your head. If they make any sort of change that affects the cost, then they get charged for that. Every studio is going to push back against that, but then you explain why it's in their best interest to have the best work possible on their project, and hopefully they go along with it. But we always protected ourselves that way.
Yeah, it seems like the flat rate bid is one way that a company can go out of business, because they'll get pressured to make more and more changes. It's like, well, this is a high profile project and you want to look good on this and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's pretty much been the death of many, many, many studios.
All right. Well, Jeff, let's talk specifically about some of the films you all have done. You all have worked on some of the Batman films.
Mm-hmm. Dark Knight, Dark Knight Rises.
For Dark Knight, you all did that car sequence.
Yeah, the Lower Wacker Drive in Chicago, which was a really fun sequence.
I saw it, and I wasn't thinking, obviously, this is a miniature sort of thing, because you have a lot of fast-moving vehicles, and the camera is moving fairly quickly. Tell us a little bit about what was involved in making that happen.
So we built a scale model Batmobile, full working RC car, so it's remote control, but it also had to be engineered to survive the crash with a garbage truck. And so it you could almost think of it as a miniature armored vehicle. To get it up to the speed and force it needed to do the damage it needed to do, it was actually on a launch system, so almost like a rail type catapult system that was underneath the road surface. And so it would travel along the rail, and then at a certain point, it would come off the rail and be freewheeling, and the RC operator would control the vehicle from that point to do. It does like a little spin out and then goes back the other direction. Force of the rail system was enough to have it run into the garbage truck, cause the damage, and push it up into the roof of the structure. And so we built a scale model of the lower Wacker drive, which if memory serves me correct, was, I want to say, somewhere around 120 feet long section of lower Wacker drive. Highly detailed, Al.
And you say you built it to scale. What scale was it?
I'm trying to remember offhand, but I want to say probably either third or quarter scale.
Okay. So still pretty big, pretty sizable. It's not exactly miniature, right?
Yeah, most of our miniatures are still quite large.
How fast was the vehicle going?
Memory serves me correct. I do believe it is 20 feet per second. So it was moving at a very fast and dangerous clip.
And then you have the radio controller aspect.
Correct.
Did the vehicle survive? I mean, were you able to salvage it for multiple takes?
Yeah. So we actually did, same as what we normally do, multiple takes. And so the vehicle itself had very little damage, although we have spare parts to correct any damage that happens on the vehicle.
The benefits of using an armored vehicle, right?
Right. The garbage truck, which we actually designed, we took LiDAR scans of a real garbage truck and built that to scale, was designed to be more flimsy, so it would crumple up and get the damage that we wanted. And it also had repairable parts on it. So once a part got all smashed in, we could just pop off those sections and replace them.
For a sequence like that, would you build more of those vehicles because you know they're not as well fortified, or you just built three of everything?
We just built three of everything. Although, you know, we did test leading up to it where we would run it through. And those would be test builds that weren't actually the two takes that we have spare parts for those as well. We also had to build a custom robotically controlled camera car to run through along with the Batmobile as it's traveling along. So it's if you watch the behind the scenes videos, you see this kind of little metal camera car that's traveling along with it on a tether.
Were you all using 3D printing even back then, pre-visualizing and then printing out the stuff?
Not on that project. We did have a 3D printer back then. At the time, we had a large scale wax printer, but that one, everything was still being like hand fabricated.
That was around the time when 3D printing was starting to take off, right?
Correct. And we were starting to make the transition ourselves to like more advanced 3D printers, resin-based 3D printers.
All right. Well, let's talk about another project you worked on, Hugo. Mm-hmm. You did the train sequence for that one. And one of the things that sold it for me was all the details on the magazines and papers.
Yeah.
And it was so specific. It felt so real. And then I saw some of the behind-the-scenes footage you all released, where you all are meticulously placing each and every one of those miniature magazines.
Yeah. And the magazines are like real scaled-down miniature magazines, usually with historically accurate stuff on them.
So someone could freeze frame and magnify it to read news from the late 1800s and whatnot?
Correct. So they put a lot of thought and detail into making things as accurate and perfect as can be. And that one was a challenging project, and that we were actually matching to a real historical train accident, and including matching up exactly the landing position of the train after it crashes out of the window, smashed down to...
Oh, that's right, because it's based on the famous photo.
Right.
So it's got to fall fairly accurately.
Exactly accurate. And so we had to engineer that huge moving train falling out of a window and landing in the exact same position as that historical photo.
That must have been a little nerve-wracking.
Yeah, it was a real challenge because the actual train we built is pretty much like a real train. It's made out of metal. It's had to be strong enough to survive the crash and not have damage beyond what was in the picture. And so it was a huge, heavy train. And and building the knuckle connections between the cars so that when it did come out, it twisted and landed in that correct position was a real engineering challenge.
How many trains did you all ruin trying to get it to fall exactly in a position? Or did you get it right the first time?
Well, we built one train, but with repairable parts on it. So that train like kind of like the Batmobile, is built like a tank. It was very, very strong. But we did shoot that one twice.
What was your role in that sequence? You were doing previs and...
Did previs, worked out timings for how things had to move to look as realistic as possible. So when you're scaling things down, you have to work out, you know, the speed of objects traveling. And also, you know, you're shooting at a higher frame rate usually to give things a sense of scale and motion.
What sort of frame rate? Do you remember?
That one was probably somewhere around 80 frames per second, but depending on what we do, we sometimes shoot thousands of frames per second. So like a movie like Bad Boys 2, where we had the bullet shot, where the bullet was traveling through like glass jars and eventually hitting the character in the butt. That was actually shot on film with like a military high-speed camera.
Probably at what? You said thousands of frames?
Yeah, I think that one was somewhere around like 2,000 frames or higher per second.
I want to take a quick break from our conversation with Jeff Jasper. Usually this is a part of the show where I tell you a little bit more about some of the things I'm working on. This time, I want to hear more about some of the things you're working on. Are you an effects artist, an illustrator, someone who does concept work, or a craftsman, a filmmaker, whatever? Send me samples of your work. If I like it, I'll possibly include links to it on the page or an image or something. It's a way to get to know who's doing what in the community. And it's possible I might be in a position where I need to use your services, or maybe I just know someone else who's looking for that thing you offer. It's all about trying to develop a community and working together after all. So if that's of interest, shoot me an email. It's podcast@ncivitis.com. Once again, podcast@ncivitis.com would be great to check out some of the things you're up to. All right, now let's get back to our interview with Jeff Jasper. Going back to the train, in the event that it didn't land exactly where it needed to go, were there digital tricks you had ready, or did you have to get it practically?
We were working, because there was some digital integration with Pixelmundo, was the digital house working with us. So we were working closely with them. They came once we had everything built. They came and took a lot of high-res photography of the train. And we gave them, as we typically do, we actually gave them the models that we used to build the train. So they had a one-to-one copy of our train that's to scale.
How long did it take you all to put together all those magazines and paper bits?
For the full kind of design phase, design and build phase, is probably a good few months of all the like building and detailing of the set.
Another thing that's interesting about that sequence is that it's combined with a foreground actor, and that helps sell the illusion or hide the miniatures, so to speak. Are there other techniques that you all use or filmmakers use to hide the awareness that there's a miniature in the shot?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing is for doing miniatures is detailing how fast you shoot it, camera position and stuff, and to try and get that sense of scale. Because if you shoot a miniature at the typical 24 frames per second, it just looks small. It looks like a miniature. So you tend to shoot like a higher frame rate. And then you add in all the integration. So like you said, live action people composited into the scene really help kind of sell that it's a real space. Plus, we're usually a lot of our shots where we have a miniature that's maybe comped into live set that's also got other digital stuff happening in there, and making sure all the lighting is matched up between all of that stuff is really key.
All right, so now let's talk briefly about your work on Interstellar. And you all actually won the Oscar for that, right?
Correct. One of the co-owners accepted the Oscar for New Deal, along with Double Negative.
But you still get to say, hey, I was part of the team. I'm an Oscar winner.
Yes, I do.
There you go. So tell us about that.
We build the Ranger ship as well as the large craft that they're traveling on that the Rangers attached to. So we built both the smaller ships as well as the large ship, and we built it at multiple scales.
I read on FX Guide's coverage that you were actually tracing the direction of the debris and gravity, but in parts of the movie, there were areas where gravity was behaving differently. So talk a little bit about that. That must have been fairly complicated.
Yeah, we had a Double Negative gave us previs of the scene where the one Ranger ship collapses into the main ship and causes a large explosion and pieces are flying off. And obviously the ship is spinning, so you have this kind of pinwheel of debris flying off, as well as the one ship kind of spinning off as it disconnects. And so they kind of came to me and are like, how can we shoot this? Is there a way to orient it that we can shoot it, that we can use gravity to our advantage to get the look of this zero G destruction in the real world where we're shooting and stuff is going to fall towards the earth? So what I did is I traced each of the particles in the previs, their path, figured out a consistent kind of direction in each of the shots, and oriented the bulk of the particles falling towards Earth. So that meant that the ship was kind of canted upside down. And so when the debris would fall towards Earth, it would look like it was matching up the zero gravity debris from the previs. And then any of the other pieces that were coming off in other directions, we actually put those on cable pulleys, and actually the mechanical computer controlled pulleys would pull them off at the right speed and direction that they needed to go.
Right. Sort of like motion control so that it could be repeated precisely.
Correct.
When you say you were tracing the paths, was that through simulation or were you going in and individually animating each piece?
No, as just pretty much deconstructing it. I was using Luxology's Modo. So I had the animation and I'd just plot. So the particle would be at this position on this frame and this position on this frame, and just kind of trace that through the whole sequence and create a motion path for that particle. And then I would look at all the motion paths for all the particles and find like a general direction that was most dominant.
And there were hundreds, if not thousands, of particles, right? I mean,
yes,
we're not talking just a few dozen of them. Must have kept you busy for a while.
Yeah, I tried to do it as procedurally as possible. But yeah, it was time consuming, as well as, you know, just once we kind of figured that out, trying to figure out then how to rig things to hold the ship in that position. Because for that sequence, that was our largest scale model, which I do believe was a third scale model. And so it was so large, it actually was above the roof of our stages. It was quite a gigantic model. And so we had to have a crane hold up the model, but not be in the way of actual production shooting the model.
Right. So you have the oxymoron of a gigantic miniature.
Correct.
Did Christopher Nolan ever come by and give you all feedback on his specific vision of outer space?
Yeah, he did. He came for our pre-shoots and also our actual shoots. That was one of the projects where we're able to kind of nail his vision on the first shoot. And so we kind of went back to him and we're like, you know, we can really kind of up the game here on the second take if you're willing to go. And so we went a little crazier with, so we have a, had a camera that was traveling on the nose cone of the ship that falls away, as well as a camera that's traveling with the debris and crashing down into with fire onto the ground, which we actually built a custom Pelican case protected camera that we called the Pelicam for that. And then for the other camera, we actually had a crane so that when it fell away, it would swing away just before it hit the ground and got destroyed.
Okay, so it sounds like you all smashed a camera or two or got close to it. Did they survive, all the cameras?
All the cameras survived. So the Pelicam took the brunt of the force and survived getting blown up and crashing to the ground.
Did you get to attend the Oscar ceremony and partake in all the festivities that went along?
Unfortunately not. No, only Ian got the invite to go to the Oscars, but he was quite excited. But I did watch it on TV with the family, and we all cheered when it was announced that Interstellar won.
Did you at least get any special gifts, headshots from the actors or anything? Oh, thank you. It's autograph. Much love.
They did send some like Interstellar cookies and champagne. And
okay.
Stuff.
They had special cookies for the Oscar campaign?
Yeah, so we got some treats.
Is there any other project you want to tell us about where you're proud of the work that you all did?
Yeah, I mean, one interesting thing about New Deal is we've taken our knowledge of movie production, and New Deal's actually shot some movies in-house, like independent movies, and we've also taken that into, we've been doing a lot of VR work over the last few years.
For like Oculus Rift or just in general?
The nice thing is we've had camera companies like John and Nokia and Google and places like that come to us, approach us with their camera prototypes and want to do tests before they actually kind of launch those onto the public. And we're always of the mindset, rather than doing boring tests, we'll actually do short story. So we have a few that we've done for VR that are really, really interesting projects. So we're pushing on that front to do cinematic VR.
That sounds neat. Are any of those out?
Yes. One Nokia launched with was called Mutiny, which is a pirate story where we built a miniature pirate ship and off in the distance, as well as have some actual stunt actors doing sword fighting in that. We did one, a music video for a band called Galvanized Souls that's won some awards and is done as like a kind of tongue-in-cheek Foo Fighter style music video on VR that's a real blast and has huge pyrotechnic rocket launch explosion in it, as well as some other sword fighting and fun stuff. And then we did a piece for Jaunt called The Mission, which is a World War II epic battle with full-size tanks and lots of explosions and fun stuff going on.
Oh, no kidding. Those sound like quite the captivating projects.
Yeah.
All right. Last question for you. Let's say your ideal collaborator is listening to the show. What would you want him or her to know about getting the best out of you and of New Deal Studios?
Any collaborator that comes in early to us and has us involved through their entire production process gets to know that we're going to be there and help them deliver the best possible piece that can be delivered, and we'll use whatever tools. So we're not going to force any specific pipeline down their throat, pure digital or pure practical pipeline. We do both. And so we can give them the best of both worlds, which is a kind of unique thing. Pretty much, I think Weta is the only other company that does that still.
And you guys are here in America.
We're here right in LA, where most of them are. And New Deal's held true to trying to keep LA strong as a film business hub. if they care about LA filmmaking, we're the place to go.
Awesome. Well, Jeff, really great to talk to you and hear what you're up to and the team over at New Deal Studios. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us. You take care now.
You too. Thanks.
And that's my interview with Jeff Jasper. Right as we were leaving, we had a little bit of static on the line, but Jeff was basically saying goodbye and telling us that if we want to learn more, we can find out about New Deal Studios on their site, newdealstudios.com. I'll include it in the show notes. Jeff has worked on so many interesting projects, so it was a challenge to pick which ones to select. I thought about Avengers, because that's another superhero one, but I'm a little more partial to Dark Knight. I know that was two Christopher Nolan films, but I feel like Dark Knight and Interstellar are different enough that it was meaningful to talk about the work they did. And it's really fascinating because, as Jeff was explaining, sometimes they're working on these sequences for months and months, and it might be culminated in about 30 seconds, a minute or two. There really is something special about that when people are saying, hey, we want to work so hard, we want to put our entire company, creative people, engineering people, we're going to work on this goal of making something special, creating a little bit of magic for people on screen. So, some people say that they don't like learning too much about the production side because then it ruins the magic. But I think you learn about these things, you learn about the craftsmanship that goes into making it, and that enhances the experience. That makes it a little bit more magical for me that people are working so hard to put together something special that I might appreciate, just a little moment of a big film that's got lots of little moments in it. I was trying to figure out what else I wanted to talk about. I usually talk about the interview, but also related thoughts in this portion of the episode. And I was not sure, feeling a little uninspired. I won't bore you with all the details, but some discouraging developments. And so anyway, I went back and rewatched Interstellar. And what a moving experience that is, that always touches my heart. I've seen the film a couple of times. And so I thought, all right, well, we could use this as a chance to talk a little bit about Christopher Nolan films. We talked about two of them here, and Jeff has also worked on some of the others. It's interesting with the Christopher Nolan films, particularly the ones that aren't superhero related. Let's exclude the Batman ones for now. But there's this way of interpreting them. It's like there are a couple ways that you could interpret them. What's more, there's usually some kind of cipher in the film that affects the interpretation in a big way. In Memento, it's the bit about Sammy Jenkins. Guy Pierce's character's got the tattoo. Remember Sammy Jenkins? And you see Sammy Jenkins and you think, okay, well, that doesn't relate because it's not exactly the same. And he learns it was like, oh, he was misled. But it's interesting that his character is similar to Sammy Jenkins, but different. And that actually affects the entire interpretation of the film. I won't tell you why, but if you're curious, go back and look. Is there a cipher sort of like that in Inception? Christopher Nolan's most maze-like film? Yeah, I'm fairly certain there is, but I'm not telling. It's one of those things, you see it and you think it has one function, but it actually has a very different function. It's cluing you into something. And then when you see it, it's pretty clear. It's pretty clear. There is no doubt in my mind about it. Is there something like that for Interstellar? Yeah, I would say so. In this case, it's the poem by Dylan Thomas, "Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night." And you read it, read the whole poem, not just what they quote there, but read the whole poem. And then what are they talking about throughout the film? There's this interesting back and forth. One of the things that they go back and forth on, ghosts. Even at the very beginning, the little girl asks her dad, are you one of the ghosts? And it's like, no, it's ghosts or gravity. And there is this back and forth, supernatural or gravity. Back and forth, ghosts, gravity. Which one is it? And, you know, some people have commented that there are striking similarities between Interstellar and 2001, A Space Odyssey. They've even broken down the sequences and compared shot by shot. Here's this moment, here's that moment. And Christopher Nolan has acknowledged that the film is an influence. But I would suggest this might even be a response to the film. I mean, you can even line up. A lot of things line up, but there are some differences, right? Who's the villain in 2001? It's Hal, the technology. In this one, the twist, who's that come from? What's his name? Well, I don't want to ruin it for you, so go back and take a look. But it's around the time that the Hal thing happens, right? You know, when Stanley Kubrick was being interviewed about 2001, what does this mean? Here's what he said, one of his quotes from Stanley Kubrick himself. On the deepest psychological level, the film's plot symbolizes the search for God, and it finally postulates what is little less than a scientific definition of God. Interesting. Interesting thing to say there, Stanley Kubrick. Huh. I wonder, does that relate in any way to Interstellar? Well, who knows? Who knows? They do mention supernatural sometimes. And there's also this idea that's different than 2001 about the influence of love. In fact, it almost has that medieval feel to it. In the Middle Ages, there was this idea of the music that moves the spheres. Love. That binds us all together. And you have that here. More than hints of it. Anne Hathaway says it, acknowledges that this is a force that affects us. What's it mean? And, you know, then there are other parts. I mean, there's also this one bit that was just like, what is this? Brand is saying, scientists, explorers, that's what I love. Out there, we face great odds, death, but not evil. And then Cooper says, nature can't be evil. She responds, formidable, frightening, not evil. Is a tiger evil because it rips a gazelle to pieces? And then Cooper says, just what we bring with us then. What's that mean? Well, I don't know. Probably nothing. But it is interesting, the setup. I mean, it is the Lazarus Project. They make reference to it. It's about something. And then it's 12 Ranger launches. Because 12, it sounds familiar. 12 somewhere. I've heard it. The 12, I don't know. You know, there's a line that Cooper's saying earlier, where he's talking, reminiscing about his wife, which he said, she says, now I realize once we're parents, we're just the ghosts of our children's futures. Ghosts again, keeps coming up. What does it mean? Well, who's got time to solve all the mysteries of the universe, right? It's about time for us to end this anyway. Oh, there is one more thing I wanted to mention about Interstellar. When they go to that planet and there's the time shift, anyone care to guess how many years they lose? It's 23. Yeah. Well, if you like Interstellar, you like outer space, metaphysical, big question kind of stories, you might also like The Hyperion Cantos by Dan Simmons. Figured I'd throw you all a sci-fi recommendation. Because I don't know, maybe some of you all like it. Like visual effects, you like spaceships, maybe you like it. I like it. I think it's a good series. Anyway, that's it for now. Thank you for listening. What's your take on the Christopher Nolan films? Or effects work in general? Again, if you're doing effects work, send me some of your work. It would be great to check out your reel, maybe post one or two of them that are interesting. Or just any other comments, suggestions you have for future guests, or just say hello. That's fine too. You can do that by email. It's podcast@ncivitis.com or leave a comment on the show page. Music for the show provided by Rob Coslow. It's the song True Gemini. All right. Until next time, let's make our future collaborations be better collaborations.